Today is Saturday, May 23rd, 2020. This is part two of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Esther Litton, E-S-T-H-E-R-L-I-T-T-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Esther. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Thank you. May we have your permission to record this interview over the telephone?
Yes, you do.
Thank you so much. You know, last time we talked about a number of things in the late 1930s, and you just mentioned something about college in 1938. Can you tell me that again?
Yes. I started UCLA in September 1937, and the tuition was $18 a semester, and textbooks were hardbound. And they never went over maybe $3 a text, or if it was $5, that was really expensive.
Yes.
And at that time, there were no paperbacks, although European schools did have paperbacks. But we always had to pay for a hardbound book.
Okay. And that $18, was that for one unit or for as many units as you wanted?
Well, that's a good question, because I know there was $18 in my mind, and I have this little card with all kinds of numbers on it, and I may be mistaken. That might have been the student body card, but in any case, if it was the school year, it couldn't have been over $27 at most.
Oh, my. Okay.
But $18 is the amount that sticks in my mind.
And that would have been a considerable amount of money back in 1937.
Yes, but it made it possible for a lot of students to come to college, because USC was much more expensive. It was a private school, whereas all of the University of California campuses charged the same.
Nice.
And possibly in lab courses, which I never took, you know, the science courses, they might have charged more.
I see.
For the labs. But for me, my little card says $18.
Okay. And then, and so you started in 37, graduated in 40, is that right?
41.
Okay.
June of 41.
Graduated in June of 1941. And then you mentioned in the summer of 1939, you went to Mexico. What did you do in the other summers, like in the summer of 38?
Well, I was very interested in art, and I had a chance to go to summer classes at an art school called Chouinard, which was in an area of Los Angeles called Westlake Park. And I used to take life drawing and landscape and graphic design. So the summer school there was like $50. And I did that, two or three summers, starting when I was in high school.
Were you working part-time as well?
No.
Okay.
No, I never worked part-time.
Okay, as you went through college. And then 19, let's see, so 39 was Mexico City, 38 was at the Chouinard School, and so 40, the summer school, summer of 1940, what did you do?
Well, I can't that might have been the summer when I needed another science course, and that might have been the summer that I took botany.
Okay.
And then at noontime, there was recreational swimming in the pool.
All right. That sounds nice. Yeah. And then when did you meet Martin?
Well, I met Martin in the summer of September 1937, when I was a freshman.
Okay.
I had enrolled in French 1, the first session of French, and the class had been in session for maybe a week when Martin walked in. He had registered late. He was supposed to have he took the English comprehensive in June of that year, but he had flunked it, so he was going to have to take it again in 1938. And to pass the time and possibly I don't know what else he took. He might have taken something to remind him of the English classes. He enrolled in French 1.
Got it.
We were seated alphabetically. My last name started with a C, but there was only an empty seat next to me. There were no seats up in the L section.
Okay.
So he was seated next to me.
Nice. And then did you guys start going out together then in the fall of 37?
Yes. Since we were in the French class, he invited me to a French movie,
okay,
which was in a fine arts theater a couple of times. And then since he was in ROTC, he would show up sometimes in the uniform for the ROTC, which had the scabbard and blade and the jumpers and the boots, and it's very militarily impressive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, okay. What else did you do in that fall of 37 together?
I don't think we did much except a couple of movies.
Okay.
I think in the spring, he enjoyed picnics, so I think we picnicked out to the wildflower fields. Actually, I think that he drove me out to Antelope Valley, where I live now, because of the poppy fields.
Oh, wow.
So our dates were primarily picnics, and which I enjoyed, and he always, and that was what we did.
Nice, nice. You mentioned he was working for the L.A. Times. When did he start working for the Times?
He started working for the Times, let's see, 38, 39, I'm thinking December 38 and January 39 when he was working at the Dude Ranch. And then when that ended around February, I think that was when he started working at the Times.
So February of 39?
Well, I don't know whether it was right at February, but it was within that year that he started working at the Los Angeles Times.
And he started off cleaning the machines, is that right?
Yes, he started out in the basement cleaning the glue off of the machines and getting the newspapers that were being printed. They were being bundled, and then he had to pick up the bundle, and it was pretty much heavy labor.
Yep. And how long did he do that before he transitioned out into the classifieds area?
Well, I don't know specifically what time, but possibly in the 40s, he moved up into the classified area because he was called into service on July 41, 1941.
Okay. All right. So in the summer of 1939, you went to Mexico.
Yes.
And then in the summer of 1940, what did you do?
Took botany.
Ah, yes. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Was that enjoyable?
Oh, yes. Yes, it was. It was very low-key. I think the professor didn't want to be too demanding, so it was not a difficult course to take.
Nice. That can be really fun, those kind of classes.
Yes, it was very fun. And then I did the swimming in the school pool at noontime.
Okay. All right. And then remind me again, when did you and Martin get married?
October 27, 1942.
Okay. 1942. So I have a couple more summers to sort out. That would be the summer of 1941. Now, you graduated in June of 41, is that right?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And then what did you do?
Well, it turned out that in July 41, when Martin was called in, he invited us to come up to see him in San Francisco. He was stationed at the, I forgot the name of the but it was in Marin County, the airport, or the airfield where he was stationed. And so my mother and my cousin and I drove up to see him there, and he took us over to the Russian River. He had borrowed a home that belonged to one of the officers on the Russian River.
Wow.
And we were able to stay in that little cabin on the Russian River. And my cousin, who was about 15, he We had a canoe, and we canoed on the river, and Martin came to see us up there. But that essentially was the summer of 41. I don't remember any other particular thing. But I did go back to the university in the fall to do the practice teaching.
What was that about? Can you tell me more?
Well, I was supposed to do practice teaching in art, because art had been my major, and then I was supposed to do practice teaching in a language, which I did in Spanish. And in 41, you know, after Pearl Harbor, I do remember standing in the schoolroom sometime in January of 42, when everybody was all excited about the possibility of being bombed by Japanese planes or submarines coming ashore and all that sort of thing. It was a very worrisome time.
I bet. And I did want to ask you as well, after your mom and dad divorced, did you stay in touch with your father?
Yes, I did. He actually, when he was still at home, he would get the Sunday paper. This was before he left, but he would get the Sunday paper and spread it out on the table. I was bilingual, but he didn't speak Spanish. But he would open it up, and he would read for me the funny paper, which was the Cats and Jammer Kids, Maggie and Jiggs, and Felix the Cat.
Nice.
I always remember he would read the captions. But anyway, when he left, sometime after he left in the summertime, he did take me to the beach. And then later on, when Disney came out with the Three Little Pigs cartoon, which became very popular, it wasn't a full-length cartoon, but he took me to see that. We had to stand in line to get in to see the Three Little Pigs.
Wow.
And then later on, as I went into high school and all the visits dropped, and I think in retrospect, as I think back over the years, I think he was not well. He had remarried, and he had asthma. As a child, he'd always had a problem with asthma.
Ah.
And when I did visit him years later, he was in a wheelchair.
Okay. When did he pass away?
Well, that's a good question, because I don't remember the date.
Okay.
But one of my cousins, who was a lawyer, called me to say that he had seen in the obituaries of my father's death.
Oh.
And he had left $3,000. And did I want him to try to recover the $3,000? And I said, absolutely not.
Mm.
No, and I felt that his wife should have that, which was little enough at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know the year, but it was after I graduated from college.
Okay, so 1942, 43, somewhere in there?
Possibly later than that. I really don't know. I know that, I'll know what. I had my first child in 46, June of 46, my son. And I do remember I called my father to say I wanted to come with my son to show him his grandson. And he said, no, don't come. And I was very hurt. And in the years that have gone by, and thinking back, remembering that he was in a wheelchair and he had asthma, he possibly was too sick to see me, and he didn't want to contaminate the baby. And that's the only reason that I can think of that he would say, no, don't come.
Oh, that would make sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's something I've had to think about over the years, and thinking back, I realized that was the logical reason for his saying, no, don't come.
Okay. So let's go back then a little bit to the botany class, 1940. By this time, you'd known Martin for 2 or 3 years. Were you guys getting a little more serious then?
In December of 41, he gave me the engagement ring, and I accepted his proposal.
Okay, nice. Nice. And then,
in fact, I thought that being proposed to and accepting was cast in concrete, because one of the girlfriends I had in college during that summer when I was taking botany, she said she had broken off her engagement because she and her fiancé had decided to wait until the war was over. And I was appalled. I couldn't believe that if somebody was engaged, that you didn't break it off.
Yeah, huh, right. And so engaged in 41 in December, and then when did Martin get called up for service?
Well, in July of 41.
Okay. All right, right.
And he was assigned to this field in Marin County, an airfield that had fighter pilots, and he was assigned. He was second lieutenant. And he was infantry, and he was doing just bookwork, but he applied for the Air Force because he wanted to fly very, very much.
Right,
but he was rejected because he was
colorblind.
Colorblind.
Yeah, and you mentioned then he got into glider training.
After July, between July and December, the whole group from that airfield was sent back east on what they called war games.
Okay.
And those took place in the swamps of Louisiana and Arkansas, and went on into North Carolina, and they returned to Oakland, a small airport in Oakland, around the 1st of December.
Did Martin send you letters during that fall, during that time when he was in the war games?
He probably did. I don't remember. I know he sent me some pictures.
Okay.
Pictures of the train ride across the country, and then some little shacks. He took pictures of some of the little shacks in Louisiana, and there were some pictures of the snow had already begun to fall by November. And he sent me some pictures of the snow in North Carolina.
Wow. Nice. And then you were writing him back as well, I'm assuming, back and forth?
I think so.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. So then he came back in the late fall.
No, I couldn't very well write to him because the whole thing, when they were moving, it was war games, and they were in one place one time and another place. So it wasn't really in a fixed position.
Okay, got it. Yeah, all right. And so he comes back in the late fall of 41.
Yes, and back. At that time his mother and I went up on a train to see him. She had a brother who lived in Palo Alto, and we stayed with her brother, and her brother drove me up to Oakland to see Martin. And that's when Martin gave me the ring, and I accepted his proposal, and he drove me back to Palo Alto.
Fun. Okay. And then let's roll into 42. What do you remember about 1942?
Let's see, 42, I guess, well, we were engaged, and I think that he wanted me to find some property so that we could eventually build a house, and I was... I think I was in college at the time, was I?
Well, let's see. You would have graduated and maybe...
I was doing the practice teaching.
Okay. Was that for a year, that practice teaching?
Well, yes, you had to do your practice teaching to get your credential.
Okay.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So I had done practice teaching in art, and then I did the practice teaching in Spanish. And it turned out I did it in Spanish because... During my visit to Mexico this summer of 39, I had met the professor who would assign the practice teaching sessions. And she said, well, I was so fluent in Spanish that I shouldn't do it in French, even though I had not majored in Spanish. She thought for practical purposes, since I knew Spanish, that I should do my practice teaching in Spanish. Which I did.
Good.
So that was in the spring of 1942.
Okay. And so after Pearl Harbor, clearly, you know, the U.S. then goes to war against Japan.
Yeah, and at that time, when they came back and they didn't accept Martin and the flying, there was a notice about they wanted to train glider pilots. So he approached that, and he was accepted for glider pilot training. So obviously he was in glider pilot training in 42.
What did you think about that, and what did you know about gliders, and what did know about planes and flying?
Well, I didn't know anything about it, and I don't remember that he even told me that that was what he was going to do.
Okay.
Suddenly, there he was in Texas, in either Dalhart or Waco or Lubbock or Little Rock, Arkansas. And no, I didn't think much. Actually, I had another boyfriend.
Okay.
So I wasn't, well, I shouldn't say that, because at that time I had left the other boyfriend. I was engaged to Martin.
I was going to say, wait a minute, I got to work out this timeline. You're engaged to this guy and you're visiting with that guy. Wait a minute, clear this up for me. Thank you.
No, the other boyfriend, his father had taken him out of school and taken him up to build Camp Roberts up north.
Okay.
In San Luis Obispo County. So he was out of the picture physically.
Okay. Good. It might have been trouble. Okay, so Martin's in Texas for glider training in the spring of 42.
Yes, and he went from one post to another. They would start the training in one place like Dalhart, and then they'd move him on to, say, Waco, and I'm just guessing. And at each time he had a change, they would ask him for his medical record, and he'd say, well, it'll catch up with me. It hasn't caught up with me yet. So when he got to the final place, which I don't remember where it was in Texas, they said, well, you know, you have to fish or cut bait here. And so he didn't say he was colorblind. He knew that the test was coming up, the Rorschach test.
Okay.
And with all the dots. And one of his friends took the test out of the desk. And so Martin memorized all the dots. And so when he went to take the test, they opened up the book, and he started reeling off the numbers. And they said, are you sure you can see those numbers? And he said, oh, yes, he had them all memorized. Well, it turned out there were two sides to the book.
Oops.
And there was another side. So they said, well, let's try the yarn test. Well, he had gone with a friend, and the friend was sitting opposite him. And there was this tray of yarn before him, and they'd ask him for the colors. And if he picked the wrong color, he got kicked under the table. So he managed to muddle through the yarn test, and I think they probably realized that he wasn't, that he was getting help. But they were desperate, I think, for the glider pilots, and they had spent all this money training him.
Right.
So they passed him, and then they sent him to Bowman Field, Kentucky, to wait to be assigned.
So I'm curious, because I know that in future years, Martin is going to take, well, he's interested in photography. He's a camera guy.
Yes.
How did his colorblindness impact his ability to understand colors? Or did he stick specifically to black and white? Or
No, he did a lot of color photography. And there's something curious about that. He can distinguish between red and green, but it's a different, it's hard to understand. I don't know, it's a shade of gray. But the thing is, this is going ahead, because after the war, when they offered him a job at the Times, they said, well, how would you like to work in the color lab and work with color photography? So he had to tell them that, no, he wouldn't be any use to them in the color lab because he was colorblind.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I kind of wondered how that might work out. But well, okay, so going back, this is in the spring into the summer of 1942.
Correct.
Where like you say, they're desperate for pilots, for glider pilots, because
yes.
Didn't the glider pilots have a reputation of, it's a one-way flight. You don't get to take gliders up in the air again once you land them on the ground.
Correct.
So that may be why they were desperate.
Yes. was, I think it was Montgomery's idea of having glider pilots. I'm not sure, but it was a campaign that they were going to use gliders at a certain point,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't need them until that particular time. So he was waiting around in Bowman Field, Kentucky, in the spring of 43. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so hang on a second, because let's finish off 1942.
Yes.
So you complete your practice teaching in this spring of 42, and then what did you do that summer of 42?
I don't remember what I did the summer of 42. I'm sorry.
No worries. it's only 80 years ago.
The fall of 42, I was doing my practice teaching. And in October, Martin had finished the glider training, and he sent me a telegram about, October the 20th, saying, I have 2 weeks off. I have to report to Bowman Field, Kentucky. I'm coming home so we can get married.
Wow. And
so I had a week to get ready to get married. And my mother, I said, well, gee, this is awful fast. I don't have to do it right away. And she said, well, you don't want to be cut short that he comes and you're not prepared.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a sale of bridal gowns at Bullock's, and I got one for $39, $29, and the shoes, and so, and anyway, so I was prepared that way.
Okay.
And we decided it would be the church, his mother's church, which was Englewood Methodist Church across the street from the Dog and Cat Hospital. And
where was that?
The minister very well.
Where was that?
And he said, I hope nobody smokes because we just finished our hospitality room and I don't want anybody in there smoking.
Esther, so, Esther, where was the Englewood Methodist Church?
Where was the what?
Where was the Englewood Methodist Church?
It was on Redondo Boulevard in Englewood. It was the main drag. And it was, as I say, across the street from the Dog and Cat Hospital.
So in Los Angeles?
The Inglewood.
Okay. I'm sorry. My California geography is bad.
Oh, well, Inglewood is a suburb. It's
okay.
It's not within the Los Angeles
got
limits.
Okay. Got it. And Martin's mother was living in Los Angeles at the time.
No, they were across. They were in Englewood. The Dog and Cat Hospital was in Englewood.
Okay.
On Redondo Boulevard.
Right. I was confused because I thought she was living in Oakland, way up in San Francisco.
Oh, wait a minute. No, let's see. At the end of the maneuvers, they had returned to Oakland, which is up in the Bay Area, San Francisco area.
Got it.
And his mother had been born and raised in San Francisco.
Okay.
She was very loyal to San Francisco.
Hmm.
But when she got married, her husband got his first veterinary job was in a dairy area in Southern California, an area called Gardena.
Okay.
And he dealt with large animals at that time, and it wasn't paying well. He was getting chickens instead of money, and so he changed to the small animals, and he opened a dog and cat hospital on Redondo Boulevard in Englewood.
Got it.
And there was a house next door to the hospital, so that Martin's mother could run over to the hospital if there was an emergency or she needed to help her husband in some way. So it was just a driveway away.
Nice. Very nice.
Which is where Martin grew up.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That makes sense now.
Okay.
All right. Okay, so that makes perfect sense as a place to get married. And what day did you tie the knot?
October 27th.
Okay. What do you remember about that?
Well, I just remember that I had the gown, and gasoline was very sparse, and we let my relatives know I was getting married. Some could come, some couldn't because of the gas situation.
Okay.
And headlights were being blacked out. So I don't remember how many people, but it was immediate family, and some immediate family on Martin's part. I'll tell you something funny. His father did not come to the wedding.
Why not?
Well, because he had not gone to his daughter's wedding a couple of years before that. He had not approved of the young man she was marrying, so he refused to go to her wedding. So when Martin was getting married, he said, "Well, I can't go to Martin's wedding when I didn't go to Marjorie's." So he didn't come to the wedding.
Well, wait a minute. Didn't he approve of you?
Not really, no.
Oh?
No, he didn't like the idea that Martin had a Mexican girlfriend.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
Because in his early years in California, he had made his way to the Imperial Valley and had worked on a ranch. And the labor was all coming over from Mexico.
Uh-huh.
So his experience with Mexican people was the Mexican laborers.
Huh.
And when Martin said he was dating this Mexican girl, I think he did it to provoke his father. But anyway, his father, later on, was a jewel. He was perfectly lovely, and we were great friends, and he was very loving.
Well, you won him over.
He was austere. He didn't show affection very much, but he was very good to me, and
nice.
I was very fond of him.
What about your relationship with Martin's mother?
Oh, excellent. Yes. No, we got along just fine.
Fun.
She was such a lovely person, and she was just lovely.
Nice. Okay, so October 27, 1942, where did you go for your honeymoon?
Well, we made our way to Riverside to the Mission Inn.
Okay.
And then the next day, we drove through the desert. I remember we went up to Amboy Crater, which was along the road, and we made our way to Needles. And it took all day and a good deal of the night.
Wow.
To get to the Grand Canyon. So when we got to the El Tovar, of course, the dining room was closed, but they very kindly brought us something to eat. And so we stayed at the El Tovar that night. And in the morning, we got up very early. And I think that we went to the Emery Kolb studio. Emery Kolb and his brother, in the years before, in the early 19, whatever it was, they had rode down part of the Colorado River.
Uh-huh.
And they had a movie about their experience. I think they're still showing it. But it was very interesting. And Martin said, "Oh, we've got to do that." And I thought that was crazy. I'd never do that.
Huh.
But anyway, I remember we saw that little film. And then we drove along the edge of the South Rim and then started on. And we went through Cameron. We went through Tuba City, through what's now the Navajo National Monument.
Uh-huh.
And on up to Moencopie. I have to stop because we got as far as Golding's trading post in Monument Valley.
Yep.
And we spent the night in Golding's trading post. We were the only guests there, obviously. Nobody else had guests. And they very kindly showed us a slideshow of other parts of Monument Valley.
Oh, wow.
And they said, "Do get up early before dawn." And they showed us where the different little roads, the sand roads and all that, were in the valley, so that we could wander around in there before we took off. And we did. We got up at dawn and went down, and it was just driving through a sand wash, really.
Yep.
very few roads, and we saw them totem poles on the W, we had a movie camera my mother had given us for the wedding present, so he took some movies of me running over the red sand.
Oh, nice.
And I don't think we met anybody at all.
Right.
On that day. And so from Monument Valley, we went on up to, Tuba City, Cameron and Tuba City, Moencopie, and all of those other. And Tuba City was just this octagonal trading post. It was a fascinating building with just a few hogans, and the road to it was just a sand road. There were just a few hogans around. And recently I saw a picture of Tuba City, and it's a regular town.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, Tuba City.
Let's back up a minute, Esther. Do you have any thoughts on your first view of the Grand Canyon?
Well, it's like a scene set, you know? It's like a backdrop. And it's not that. It's very impressive, but so far away.
Yeah, okay.
You know, it's not, you don't get the feel of it at all. I feel sorry for Japanese tourists who come in a bus and they stand there and somebody takes their picture with the Grand Canyon behind them, because it's just like a stage set.
Right, right.
But it was interesting. When we drove along the road that goes along the rim, and we'd get out and look down.
Yep.
You know, and that was more impressive. That was, you know, very exciting.
Nice.
But the initial view, you know, the first, if that's all you ever see of the Grand Canyon, it's too bad.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so then from there to Cameron to Tuba City over to Kayenta, and then out to Goulding's. From Goulding's, did you continue on north to Mexican Hat and Blanding?
Oh, yes. And yes, we did. Yes, I'd forgotten. On the way, before we got to Monument Valley, we came across a Navajo who was standing by the road. So Martin stopped, and he wanted a ride, but we didn't know that behind him he had 6 bags of flour. So by the time we got the bags of flour in the car, there wasn't any room for him or me. But fortunately, cars at that time had running boards. So I stood on one running board and he stood on the other until we reached a place where he wanted to get off. But there was nothing in view. We couldn't see where he was going to go because it was just flat desert.
Wow.
But that was where he wanted to get off. And so we said goodbye.
Oh, that's a wonderful story.
Yeah.
Huh. And so heading north, you must have gone across, let's see, 19...
Yes, we went into Park. After we drove up to Pikes Peak.
So hang on. Wait. After Goulding's, going north, you would have crossed the San Juan on a little wooden bridge with a cables, and then drove right past Norm Neville's house.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And in 42, I clearly there was, you know, no connection there, but I'm just really curious to know if, you know, did you see any boats at that time or?
No. Well, we were on our way and we'd never heard of Norm Neville's. We'd never heard of people doing in 42, and we had no idea anybody went down the river.
Okay.
The only one we knew were the Cole brothers.
Okay.
With
all
their
right.
little black and white film. No, I'm afraid we skipped Neville.
How about that? Okay. Well, then heading north from Goulding's, you go through Blanding and Monticello, and then up to Moab. And Moab in 1942, what was that like? Do you remember?
Oh, I'm sorry, I don't remember Moab.
Okay. That explains it right there.
I remember we went through Durango.
Okay.
We spent Halloween night in Durango.
Okay, so maybe you didn't go up to Moab.
No, I don't remember. remember Moab at all. And Durango was, it was at night when we got there, and it was early in the morning when we left, so I really don't know much about Durango.
Where were you heading for?
We were headed for Colorado, Colorado City, Springs, Colorado Springs.
Okay.
Where I got on the train and came home, and Martin went on over to Denver.
Okay. And let's see. So from Durango to get to Colorado Springs, you would have had to go through the Rocky Mountains there. How did you manage? Do you remember?
Yeah, we did. Yes, I do. Now I do remember. I'd forgotten about that because we were up at a really high elevation, much higher elevation. I think we stopped along the way just to look at the scenery. But from going up to that elevation, we did go past the road to Pikes Peak, so we drove up to Pikes Peak.
Nice. Nice.
And in Colorado Springs, I remember we saw the Broadmoor Hotel.
Hmm. Okay. Did you spend your last night there before Martin headed off to Denver and you got the train?
Well, I don't remember specifically. We probably did because I had to get on the train to come back to California.
Right. So Martin's going to keep doing his military service. You're heading back to California. Do you remember that train ride that would have taken you up the Arkansas River and up over a high pass and down into Utah? I'm trying to think about that, how that train route went.
I don't remember the route. Probably I was asleep.
That would make sense. Oh, my gosh. Fun. So the winter of 42, when did you see Martin again?
Yes, well, on December the 31st, he came over from Texas, and I took the train to Albuquerque, and we spent New Year's Eve in the hotel there at the station in Albuquerque.
Okay.
And I remember January 1st, with my student body card, I could have attended the Rose Bowl because it was the first time in history that UCLA played in the Rose Bowl.
Oh, wow.
January 1943.
Huh. Okay.
But Martin had a car, so we drove over to Acoma, and we hiked up the trail to the top of Acoma, and it was very exciting. There was nobody there. I mean, it was just absolutely free of people at Acoma, but we met a lady who came out. I remember her name. Her name was Clara Victorino, and she had, I think, a son in the service. There was one young man on the land, so, up there dressed in a uniform, and he was visiting with another lady. We never approached him. He was off in the distance.
Hmm.
But Clara Victorino took us up into the church there at Acoma.
Wow.
And showed us the ovens and took us around the town. But there was nobody in sight. We were all alone with her up there in Acoma.
Nice.
And we hiked down, and we visited. We drove past some town, Isleta, I think. There's a town of Isleta.
Yes.
And then there's a town of, we passed several towns. We got as far on the road as Hemis Springs.
Okay.
And then we turned back. We were kind of headed for a town on the map called Cuba.
Okay.
But we never got there. We turned around and went back to Albuquerque because he had to make his way up to Bowman Field, and I had to get back to California.
So hang on a second, Esther. I want to ask you, going back to the end of October, to the El Tovar, and then on to Durango and Goulding's, was that the first time you had been east, out of California?
Yes, except for the time when I went to Mexico. Well, I take it back. No, I had been in El Paso because coming back from Mexico, the train went from Mexico City to El Paso.
Okay.
So I had been through El Paso, and then I think I had to change trains at El Paso and make my way west to California. That was in September 39.
Okay. Yeah, that would have taken you through...
That was the only time. And of course, I slept on the train, so I don't remember the scenery particularly. Mm-hmm.
What did you think about the American West as in that, you know, let's go into October then of 42 and now the new year of 42, 43.
Yeah. Well, it was all such a revelation, the desert, and it was just such a lot of open space. It was just wonderful. It was an eye-opener.
Huh. This
actually,
is...
one of my art professors, well, I think she was Navajo. I never did determine that, but she was very familiar with Monument Valley.
Okay.
And when I came back and with photographs of some particular bushes, she said, "Oh, I know that bush."
Huh.
So she was very, very glad that I had been to Monument Valley because she was familiar with it.
Nice. So I'm thinking, you know, what would one do with a day or two from Albuquerque? Well, one could go up to the Sandia Crest. One could go to Santa Fe.
Well,
but
you couldn't go to Sandia Crest because there was no tramway then.
No, you'd have to take the road around the back.
Well, we didn't. We went out on the flat part.
Okay.
Where you could see Sandia Peak. And Martin had brought a rifle, and he wanted to teach me to shoot a rifle.
Wow.
And so that was what we did out there in the middle of the desert. Now, of course, there's a tramway going up there.
Yeah.
And it's all built up on the flat.
Well, I wanted to ask you, whose idea was it to go to Acoma? I mean, that's a really scenic place, really.
Yeah.
A Spanish influence.
Yeah.
Really, really beautiful. Was that your idea to go over there?
No, I think it was just on the map.
Okay.
Yeah, I was sorry we didn't get to Inscription Rock. I think I knew about Inscription Rock.
Was that El Morro?
But we did go to Gallup.
Okay.
On our way back, we went through Gallup. But, it was all at one of the villages, whether it was Isleta or one of the other ones, where Martin just stopped and took a picture of the church. I think there was a kiva in one of the towns, and I climbed up to the top of the kiva.
Huh, okay.
Which I probably wasn't supposed to do.
Oh, well, you're probably right. I mean, you are right. But social faux pas happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the New Year's of
42-43. 43, uh-huh. January 43.
Back to Albuquerque, and then you get the train back, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And that from Albuquerque, that train would have gone through Flagstaff and the Needles, off back to Barstow, and then into L.A. Is that something? I'm trying to figure out the train route like that. Martin then went back to the service. What happened in the spring then of 1943?
In the spring of 1943, he went back to Bowman Field, Kentucky. And while he was at Bowman Field, Kentucky, he was just sitting around twiddling his thumbs, and he found out that his old group, the fighter pilot group, had been moved to St. Petersburg, Florida. So he called Washington, D.C. By this time, he was a first lieutenant. And he said, you know, my old group of such and such, whatever it was, have asked me to come and join them. So, do I have permission to join them in St. Petersburg? And they gave him permission to join them in St. Petersburg. So in the spring, he showed up at Pinellas Airport outside St. Petersburg, and I said, what are you doing here? They hadn't asked for him at all. They didn't know what they were going to do with him, but he wanted to get to St. Petersburg because he thought that I could come and join him.
Okay. How did that work out?
It worked out because because in June, I had finished my practice teaching, and so I said, okay. And so I packed a suitcase, and I got on the train, which had a lot of troops in it.
I bet.
There were two young women in the car where I was. They were very pregnant. They had been living in San Francisco with their husbands who were in medical school, and they were going back to Louisiana what's the name of the town in Louisiana? Anyway, they were going back to Louisiana and to their family homes. And so it was a train ride where was I? Lived in Los Angeles.
Right.
They were on the train, and we made our way. It was an old train. I got off at New Orleans. I had to change trains at New Orleans. I spent the night, I think it was the St. Charles Hotel, something like that.
Okay.
And spent the night there.
I'm assuming the train was standing room only?
No. We were very comfortable in the car we were in, but the other trains were pretty full of troops.
Okay, because sometimes during the war that the trains were so full of troops that
people were
standing on the little platforms between the cars. It was just packed.
Well, that wasn't our experience, thank goodness.
Okay.
No, we were fine.
Okay.
And I remember that the train that I got on in New Orleans had windows that opened. And, of course, they were steam engines, and so you'd get a lot of the smoke.
Right.
If you open the window. And going through the land between Louisiana and Florida, you went through a lot of wild country where magnolias would go wild, and they were blooming.
Oh, my.
And I remember the fragrance of the magnolias as we went by.
I bet. Yeah, wow.
And then I got off, I think it was Jacksonville or St. Augustine. I think it was St. Augustine.
Okay.
And I got on another train that went down to Tampa, where Martin met me.
Okay.
And the thing I remember was the impact of the heat, the humidity. It was just, you know, you just stand still and you're perspiring.
Yes. Yeah.
And he had rented, at that time, for some reason, part of the group was not in Pinellas, was in Sarasota. So he had rented an apartment, a second floor apartment in Sarasota.
Okay.
And I remember in June, the storms, the lightning and the thunder and the cloudbursts. It was, you know, June is there really heavy rain season.
Sure, it's a hurricane season, isn't it?
Well, I don't know, possibly, but in general, it's just their rainy season.
Okay.
Yeah, and so there was a lot of rain. And from the window of my second floor apartment, I looked down on a home down below, you know, where you go in the front door and you go straight through the whole house. It's
uh-huh.
just like an alley from the front to the back.
Yeah.
And the people in that house had a laundry business, and the women would be washing the clothes and hanging them up to dry on the clothesline. And I remember I took Martin's shirts down there for them to wash them, and it was 10 cents for the washing the shirts.
Uh-huh. Yeah. All right. And what were you doing that summer then there?
Just sort of sitting around perspiring, but then after a few weeks he was moved back to Pinellas, to St. Petersburg, and at that time there was not the bridge that exists now between Sarasota and St. Petersburg.
Okay.
So he had to drive clear around through Tampa and around, but then he found an apartment for us for $30 a month in St. Petersburg, where he was stationed at Pinellas Airport.
Okay.
And he rented a bicycle for me so I could get around, because he used the car to get to the airport.
So tell me about the car. Your big black Buick that your mom bought for you, I'm assuming that's still back in California somewhere.
Yes, I think so. I've forgotten about what happened to the black car.
And so did you guys buy a car then?
No, Martin had this little Chevy, a little Chevrolet, a four-door Chevrolet.
Okay.
And actually, let's see, I guess he had it there in Florida because he had a car. And so he had a little bit of gas, and we were able to drive out to Clearwater on the beach, and we were able to drive to Tarpon Springs down the coast, and we were able to drive up to Lake Wales. And let's see, and one time we drove out to what was called Myakka State Park.
Huh.
And on the way to this state park, there was a sign that said zoo. And we walked in there, and it was just a man who had a couple of monkeys in a cage. It was just a little home zoo. But he had this big alligator. And so he said, would somebody like to sit on the alligator and have their picture taken? Martin volunteered me.
Oh, great.
So I did. I got in there and I said, it was about 20 feet long. It was a big alligator.
Wow.
But the man said, he's very gentle. It's not like a crocodile that will snap at you. This alligator won't hurt you. So I sat on the bumpy back of the alligator.
Oh, my gosh.
And Martin took the picture of me on the alligator.
How about that? What was Martin's position there in St. Petersburg?
Well, that was a good thing because they didn't know what to do with him. So there was a small plane. I forget what the title was, but it was just a two-place plane, and they would send him down the coast to another airport with the mail.
Okay.
So he would do the mail run, and I don't know what they did with him during the day, but we were there until let's see. It was really, I know what. Somehow, the school district, maybe somebody I met, a woman who I met, or anyway, they found out that I could substitute.
Oh.
So in the high school, they asked me to come and substitute. First, it was a Spanish class, and then it was an arithmetic class.
Uh-oh.
But the thing that surprised me when I went there and started the class, they said, well, we always start with something from the Bible. I said, you do? Where's the division of church and state?
Wow. Huh.
So I had to dig through the Bible and figure out something to say at the beginning of the class. And it was really kind of shocking.
Huh.
Since then, I've talked to one of the residents here who's from North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
And I mentioned this, how surprised I was, because I'd never heard this in California.
Right.
And I said, where's the division of church and state? And she says, well, all the schools in North Carolina start with a quotation from the Bible. All the schools on the East Coast start with a quotation from the Bible. And then I realized that the school system on the East Coast was started by the churches. You know, in
Interesting.
Rhode Island, Roger Williams, and then Yale and Princeton, and I think all of those were religiously started.
Hmm.
And it spread to the school districts on the East Coast. Well, I don't know how true that is now, or how widespread it is, but just recently this lady here said, oh yes, all the schools on the East Coast start with a quotation from the Bible.
Wow. Huh. I'd never heard of that.
No, and that was very surprising to
me. How did you do substituting for Spanish? I mean, you could do that in your sleep, but mathematics, was that easy? Were you comfortable with that?
Well, it was just arithmetic, and fortunately, I think it was freshman arithmetic.
Okay.
And I muddled through that. But the thing was, the students in the higher classes, senior class, the boys, were really hard to handle, because they were dying to get into the war.
Oh.
And And they didn't want to study. They didn't want to have anything with school anymore. They were just anxious to graduate and get off to war.
Wow.
So there was one day when I went to the principal and complained about the behavior of these particular boys.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just were hard to handle.
I bet. Huh.
But in Tampa Bay, there were some ships from Russia, because there were some sailors on shore who had the Russian uniforms on.
Okay.
I never came in contact with them, but I did see them. And during our stay in St. Petersburg, we went up the Hillsborough River, which flows into the bay and goes past Tampa. And up the stream, there were some rowboats anchored, and nobody was using them. So we got in them, and we went rowing down the Hillsborough River.
Nice.
And, of course, we returned the rowboat.
Uh-huh.
It was my first experience with the kind of forest of Florida, the liquid ambers and the longleaf pines.
Nice.
And very interesting, and the palms, and very, very interesting vegetation. Oh,
yeah.
And the poison sumac.
Okay.
I came in contact with that.
Oops.
Yeah, that
oh, dear. Yeah. Oh, dear. When Martin was making the little flights in the plane for the mail run, did you get a chance to go with him on those?
No.
Okay.
No, and I I couldn't have done that at all. But one time when he was coming back and he had another soldier with him in the co-pilot seat who had just gone along for the ride, they hit a cloudburst, and they were over one of the islands offshore, and the power of the rain was so strong it forced him down, and he crashed into a house on the island. And he wasn't hurt, but it made a mess of the roof of the house that he crashed into. And when the people in the house came out, they said, well, thank goodness it wasn't yesterday, because yesterday we had my daughter's wedding right here where you crashed.
Oh, my gosh.
So anyway, the Army somehow got the plane out of their yard and got Martin back on, and the other young man back on shore. He did have a cut on his cheek, and we were between apartments at the time, and we were staying in a motel, and they called me at the motel to say that Martin had been injured. He wasn't badly hurt, but he would be late getting home.
Huh.
And so that was his experience in the small plane.
Wow, that's
it wasn't his fault, because it was just this heavy, heavy downpour that just pushed the plane right down.
Yeah, that was a lucky landing, though.
I think the armed forces paid for the repairs on the roof of the house.
Okay. So this is now we're into the fall of 1943, is that right?
No. In the March of 43, the government rounded up all of the glider pilots and told them to report to Bowman Field by such and such a time. So we only had a suitcase for clothes. It all fit into the back seat of the car. That's all we had.
So Esther, hang on a second. I'm confused about the timeline. I got messed up. Because I thought we were in the summer of 43. You had moved out to Florida.
Yes.
And this is back in St. Petersburg. So when did the glider pilots get called up?
Well, the following year.
Okay, so March
44.
March of 44.
March of 44.
Okay, so hang on a second. We've been at this now for about an hour, happily yik-yakking away.
Oh my gosh, and that's all we've gotten to? Oh, that's terrible. I'm ruined your whole Memorial Day.
I'm thrilled. I am thrilled. This has just been wonderful. I think maybe starting with the call out of the glider pilots in 1944, March of 44, might be the place to pick up the next interview.
Okay.
Do you
to be continued?
Yeah. Before I finish this off, though, Is there anything else you want to bring in about the fall of 1943 into the spring of 1944?
Well, it was just roaming around that part of Florida.
Okay.
And as I said before, we had gas. We were able to go down to Tarpon Springs. We were able to go up to Lake Wales. We did the rowboating on the Hillsborough River, which we did more than once.
Okay.
And nobody objected to our using the rowboat.
Nice.
And swimming in at Clearwater. And I had the bicycle, and I used to bicycle out to St. Petersburg on the coast, and not the coast. It wasn't on the coast. It was inland, where the canals, so the people had houses, and the pier where the pelicans came in.
Nice.
And it was just a glorious time.
Nice.
And my shopping, that was my first cooking experience, and it was the beginning of freeze-dried foods, and I remember I bought a package of bird's-eye peas, and I wasn't quite sure which way to cook them, you know, whether to put them into boiling water,
uh-huh,
or to wait and put them in the cold water, and anyway, I was learning to cook.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. How often were you substitute teaching?
Just about three times. And the reason was that the teachers who were teaching that class had husbands who were about to be shipped out.
Okay.
So they asked for permission to go to see their husbands. But after I did that teaching, they asked me if when my husband left, was shipped out, would I stay and teach there? And they wanted me to teach home economics. And I said, no, I have no experience with home economics. Because so much of the cooking in the area was on a wooden stove.
Oh, wow.
Not in town, but in the suburbs. And, of course, you had to teach the girls how to cook on a wooden stove.
Yeah.
And I was just barely able to cook on a plain old gas stove.
Oh, gosh.
And the sewing, too. So I said, thank you very much for asking me, but no, I'm going back to California.
Right. Okay. All right. With that, we'll go ahead and wrap this part two up then.
Oh, I do want to say something.
Yes, please.
You don't have to put it on the screen, but anyway, some of the ladies I met through a college organization, when they had a luncheon, and I went to it. And so these ladies were from the South. And they said, you know, when you go to visit somebody, you just have to be careful because the cooks come with a special petticoat under their dress, and it has pockets, and they steal food and they put it in those pockets and take it home.
Huh.
And also if the hostess is going to have somebody take you home, the person who's going to take you home will say, well, it's my turn to carry you home. And what it meant was they were going to drive you home.
Right.
But the term was, I'm going to carry you home.
And you were thinking about that alligator and going, wait a minute.
Yeah. But anyway, those were two little things. And it was the attitude about the colored people, you know.
Huh.
Yeah, they were very suspicious about the colored help.
Wow. Okay. Did that impact you? As I'm assuming, you know, people would have looked at you and wondered maybe you were a First Nation person or Hispanic.
No, they wouldn't have suspected anything like that.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Great. All right. Well, thank you. This is a great place to wrap up.
You're very welcome. And I hope have a lovely Memorial Day.
Well, hang on a second. Don't hang up just yet.
No, okay.
This is going to conclude part two, Oral History with Esther Litton. Today is Saturday, May 23, 2020. My name's Tom Martin. And Esther, thank you so very much.
Well, you're very welcome. This is really a pleasure. It's been digging up lots of memories.
Wonderful. Hang on a second.